Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome back to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York. And today we're out at Roberta's in beautiful, not so beautiful, rainy Bushwick, Brooklyn. But I'm very excited because I have a fellow New Yorker here. Jenny Glasgow is the executive chef of Olivia Chang, one of the most extraordinary high-end catering firms in New York City. And she's a New York City girl. She actually has a very interesting background. She has a master's degree and an undergraduate degree from Northwestern in advertising and was a senior advertising executive before she came to the French Culinary Institute to study cooking. And when she graduated, she went to work for the Matthew Kenny Group, and she launched two of their best-known restaurants, Commune and Canteen. And after that, she made her way 11 years ago into catering. And Jenny, you are the first catering chef to be on the show, and I'm very excited because it's a whole different breed of cat. So can't wait to get into it. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Happy to be the first.
Well, it's fascinating because I know a lot of people out there who are chefs have thought about, should I go into catering? A lot of people out there who are not chefs yet think, I want to be a catering chef. So we're going to go behind the screen and we're going to find out what that really means. So first of all, you grew up in the city, huh? What was that like? Is that where you earned your taste buds back?
That and, you know, whatever travels that I was fortunate to be able to take growing up. I had a father who loved food, a mother who did not love to cook. And so consequently, my father, my sister, and I all, since we all loved to eat, learned to cook at an early age. I mean, I didn't really learn till I went to FCI, but you know, I enjoyed it. It was a hobby.
So let me ask you something. You said that you traveled a lot. What? Tell us where, how, why.
Well, you know, when I was younger, we didn't have that much money. It wasn't any place terribly exotic, but we did drive down to Mexico. When I was a little older, we took a family trip to Morocco and Tunisia. My father was a Francophile. He actually was an importer of French luxury good items. So we would go to France. We went to Spain, Italy, you know. Since then, I've been to Hong Kong, Japan, pretty much all over Europe, and just looking for the next best place to eat. I'm already planning this year's vacation.
Where are you going to go?
To Italy again, but also to Central Europe. I've never been to Vienna or
Prague.
Yeah.
Well, so. Dumplings.
Yeah.
Think dumplings.
It's not going to be the same food experience as Italy, but
bring your own salad. Yeah. My mother was Czech, so I'm saying this from a real personal point of view.
Okay.
But tell me, so you grew up in, what was it like eating in the city? Do you remember the restaurants that you liked back then? And
When I was real young, it was more for the experience. Like Lu Chow's was.
I loved Lu Chow's.
And then there were a couple of good smorgasbord places because as a 5-year old, I loved to be able to really pick my food. Mm-hmm. There was the Copenhagen on 58th Street, I think it was, and I forget, there was the Kung's home and the Grip's home. One was in Chicago, one was in New York. I don't remember which was which.
So you liked all that central and northern European
food.
Yeah,
but I also always loved Italian, French, American.
But Italian back then were more...
Yeah,
you know,
it was more
red sauce. Place.
In fact, there used to be a place that we used to go to that was in the village when my parents were courting, and my father was born in 1920. And the only good thing there was the veal chop that came with a side of a spaghetti. And we used to go there because they had great veal chops. One day, all of a sudden, the menu changed, and there was all this much more ambitious stuff. And we asked the owner, what's up? And we had this fabulous meal. And out of the kitchen walks Mario Batali. It was his first job in New York.
Was that Poe?
No, it was Rocco's.
Rocco's.
It was before Poe.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
which is trivia. That's going down in the trivia book.
It was memorable.
Wow.
So
Was he wearing shorts?
At the time, I'm trying to remember... Perhaps. Orange clogs, no.
No, right.
He may not have even been wearing shorts.
So tell me, let's ask you a little bit about advertising. And how did you get into advertising?
Well, I graduated college when I was 20, and I wasn't ready for the real world. So I called up my parents. I said, would you mind if I went to graduate school? And it was a one-year program. I kind of fell into it because I was interested in it. My parents had friends when I was growing up that were in advertising, and it always seemed like a fun and creative job. But that was in the 60s. So.
Is this Mad Men?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay. It wasn't like that by the time I got into it.
Although Mad Women either.
We did have some 3 martini lunches, I must confess. Uh-huh. But it was very different. And I did it for 13 years. And the first 3 years, I loved it. The last 10 years, I was doing it for the money. Mm. So I went to a career counselor who I actually had to pay somebody to have the brilliant idea of trying to earn a living doing something that you actually enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I wanted to be a travel agent. So that's what led me to FCI.
Your love of food.
Yeah.
So now... you were an English major, correct?
Yes,
English literature, and so advertising, the use of the word, and all of that. But in food, the creative eye and articulation, you know, of calling dishes.
Uh-huh.
Do you draw on your advertising background?
I do, because it's amazing how you can take the same dish and call it, you know, 6 different things, and it'll mean 6 different things.
You want to give us an example?
Ooh.
Sorry to put you on
Ooh.
The spot.
Tuna
tartar. Have you had any?
Tuna tartar used to be our biggest seller in the restaurants every single day. We don't do a lot of it anymore. It's a little bit kind of dated. Let me see if I can think of another example.
We'll move on. You know, I'm just thinking back to Luchow's and the Oompa bands.
And
it was sort of a German brasserie, I would call it. And the food was sensational, as I recall. I have the cookbook, and I actually cook out of it. Do you, we're going to get into your menu and your style and what happens as a catering chef. But so you went on this journey to become, when you started school, did you know what kind of chef you wanted to be?
Absolutely not. And catering was probably the furthest thing from my mind. It just, it was another thing that I fell into.
So what did you expect? What was your expectation going into school?
Probably that I would stay in restaurants the rest of my life. I wasn't sure if I wanted to have my own restaurant or wanted to leave the headaches to somebody else and just do the food related aspect. Because when I was in advertising, I was in the marketing end of it, and I, you know, wanted to just
dial back.
Yeah. While I loved working in restaurants, there was a degree of repetition that after a while was not what I was looking for.
That's interesting because this is very different. This is one of the big differences I want to get into today between restaurant chefing and catering chefing and cooking. That when you go into a restaurant, just we as consumers say, I'm going back for the veal chop. It's the best veal chop in the city. Mm-hmm. And it's probably one of the most popular things on the menu. So the cooks in the kitchen are doing veal chop day in and day out. How boring was that for you?
Yeah, it is. I always wonder how actors on Broadway can give like 8 really amazing performances a week if they've been in a long-running show. Mm. And, you know, there are restaurants out there that change their menu all the time, the time. But they're few and far between.
Do you think that's for the cooks or is it for the clientele? Because when I eat something delicious in a restaurant, I think, oh, I dream of going back there and eating something delicious. And if someone can consistently put out that dish, I think that helps in the business of a restaurant, of making it popular, because people go back for a reason. If they don't go back for the decor, mm-hmm. you know, the ambience, they actually go back for the food, you would think they're going back for certain dishes.
Yeah, and absolutely that is the case. We've had customers that wanted the same meal every day. I mean, there were people that would come in 5 days a week and have the same meal. That would make me crazy. Although yes. I must confess, in high school, I used to bring a Dannon coffee yogurt and a banana for lunch every day. But that was just because I didn't have time to make anything, and it was the easiest thing. I think it's for the clientele. I think in certain neighborhoods, clientele are more likely to want the same thing again and again. Mm-hmm. But there are other restaurants where they do change the menus frequently and run a lot of specials, and that attracts a different clientele.
So, okay. So how many years did you spend in regular restaurants?
Ooh, 6 or so.
So that's a long time. So what made you get into catering?
Well, the restaurant group that I was working for had started a catering division. And it was there that I met Olivier Chang, who is the now owner of Olivier Chang Catering and Events. And when he left to start that company, I came with him, and the rest is history. We've been in business 11 years now, 12 years.
So tell me, what's the difference between a restaurant chef and a catering chef? What are, you know, there's a lot of people out there thinking about, oh, I cater out of my home. I could do this. What are the differences?
Well, the differences are great and many. However, I think that a lot of restaurants are doing more off-premise catered events, so they're learning more of what we do. You're working out of a space 90% of the time that's not a real kitchen. It's a room. Mm. You are feeding anywhere from 2 to 1,000 people at once. You have to plan your menus accordingly so that it's something that's not
a la minute.
Yes.
To be done right.
Exactly. And something that, even not a la minute, that is a little bit forgiving. There are some fish that I try not to use because they're too dry or too thin.
Oh, tell us which ones.
Halibut. I love halibut. But even olive oil poached or sous vide or whatever, if the speeches at the wedding go long, you know, it goes from perfect to dry in like minutes. Wow. I try not to serve pasta because while a lot of caterers serve pasta, and you can serve pasta, especially a baked pasta or something, to serve pasta up to the standards that I would like to be served pasta to 500 people at once, you can't do it. It's okay. It's just not great.
Why? It gets gummy?
The timing is too crucial. It gets gummy. It gets over. Same with risotto. We do a farotto, which is much, I prefer it anyway, but it's much more, it holds better.
It holds better.
Yeah. So it's smoke and mirrors. We've got clients that are expecting restaurant quality food, but in a restaurant, there's no restaurant in the world that's going to serve dinner to 500 people in, you know, a 15-minute serve out. So it's smoke and mirrors, it's planning your menus, it's making sure that your staff is well trained and gets things out like clockwork, that there's good communication between front and back of house.
Do you have a secret recipe for not serving rubber chicken? I mean, you know, I think a lot of people in banqueting and hotels, and I know you don't. So what's the difference between having the rubber chicken and your chicken? What do you have to do differently?
We actually don't sell a tremendous amount of chicken.
No, you charge too much. For those prices, I'm not eating chicken.
That's part of the reason. But, you know, a great chicken is a great chicken. Mm-hmm. We always brine our chickens. We, depending on what dish we're doing, sometimes we sous vide them after brining. You know, anything we can do to ensure that they
stay moist.
And I'm a big fan of braises. Braises are better if they're cooked the day before or even 2 days before. So we do a great chicken tagine or a great braised chicken with saffron onions and dates. So if you've got a client that will accept a little bit of a more rustic presentation, you know, a braised chicken is delicious.
That's good. Well, actually, we're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, we're going to get into the more exciting meals that you've created.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and I'm talking with Jenny Glasgow of Olivia Chang Catering here in New York, one of the top catering companies operating not only in the city, but you've actually ventured out, and I want to go there with you. First of all, how many dinners, events do you put on in a year? Tell me about the parameters of a full-blown, top-end catering firm in New York City.
I'm not sure I know how many events that we did last year, but I would say probably somewhere between 700 and 1,000.
So that means there's only 365 days a year. Mm-hmm. So that means you've got two events going per day, two to three.
Yeah, on average, there are days that we have none. There are days that we have more. Fashions night out is always a big day. Mm-hmm. But when I say events, you know, not every event has food. Sometimes we have a lot of fashion clients. Sometimes it's champagne service at their store or
celery sticks. Yeah. Wait, really? So you do events and there's no food?
Some. We're also known for staffing. We have a very good looking set of
Oh, let's go there. Yeah. So it's about the look, right?
Well, the look and the skill set. No, the skill set has to be there.
But for example, with the fashion crowd, you can't have troglodytes serving.
No.
Uh-huh. So do you have, do they say we want, you know, Beach Boys or, you know, we want nuns? I don't know. You know, but do they come in with a profile and then you go through a book of fasting?
There are certain clients where we know the look that they want, and we send them headshots. And
you have to send headshots.
You don't have to on all occasions. Mm-hmm. Some clients request them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain height that we're looking for if you're having butler drinks. That if there's going to be a row of drink butlers greeting at the door, you want everyone to be kind of the same height. It's things of like.
So this is Broadway production quality.
The front of house works as hard as the back of the house.
Yes, I see. So So tell me, how many people work for you full time?
Well, on staff in the kitchen, I would say probably about six, but we have a huge pool of regular freelancers. Some of them mm-hmm. have been with us on an almost daily basis for 10 years, 11 years.
I see.
Who really know our food, who we really trust.
So full blown, you go from, you know, six core in the kitchen, and then mm-hmm. you have to get all the front of house people and mm-hmm. the service and the people on site. On a day you're doing full blown three events, how many people have you mobilized to deliver that?
Well, in the prep kitchen, we could have as many as 30 people prepping. At events, you know, where there have been some events where we've needed 40 chefs for one particular event. Front of house has got to be at least three, four times as much per event.
So you're the executive chef. How much logistics is this, putting 40 prep chefs, three different events, in your cooking, your on-site? How do you do that? Do you have an Excel spreadsheet or something?
We do, and we're actually we're bringing in two new software programs to the office and the kitchen this season, uh-huh. so that we can spend more time on the creative end of it and less time on the logistics. If it's saving us time that way.
I see. Do you do front of house too, or is there someone
else? I don't.
Okay,
no,
someone
no.
else.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
you have a counterpart to
yes.
do that. So tell me how you conceive your menus.
Well, there's two levels of conception. There's our standard menus. I like to think that we have an infinite menu, because we do. There's our standard menus that every season we refresh and renew and take some old things off and put some new things on. And because while some people, like the people we were talking about in a restaurant, want the same food again and again, others never want to see the same thing twice.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly trying to keep those fresh mm-hmm. and seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also client-driven creative development, which is a lot of fun. We have a really diverse group of clients, and they come to us for a really diverse group of a diverse range of events. Last year alone, I did somewhere between 250 and 300 custom menus for events. Not saying we got every single event, but we did get a lot of them. And, you know, people, no two events are alike. We don't want to do cookie cutter events.
Mm-hmm.
We want to.
So can you give us an example of two different events that are so opposite?
Oh, yes, actually I can. We did a wedding for two. It was the bride and the groom. They took over the Angel Oren Sand Center, which is a big wedding venue. They hired a very well-known event planner. They had two different kinds of entertainment, and we did the catering. And they wanted a tasting menu. The bride was vegan. The groom was meat and potatoes.
Now, wait a minute. So how big is this venue? How big a room?
Oh, you could do a seated dinner for probably 300 there.
And it was just the two of them. They didn't uh-huh. invite anybody else.
Apparently not.
Amazing. And they had entertainment. They hired an event planner for
uh-huh.
the two of them.
Uh-huh.
My gosh. And so what kind of entertainment did they have?
They had a dance troupe, and I don't remember what
a
the other
dance
one, yeah,
troupe.
Yeah, I don't remember what the other one was. This goes back a ways. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we were fortunate enough to be chosen to do a royal wedding in Qatar, in Doha.
In the Middle East?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, what was that like?
It was for 1,200 Muslim women, because the women and the men do not celebrate weddings together.
Oh.
Does
the bride and the groom?
The only men that arrive at the wedding are the groom and the groom's father, who was the emir.
Uh-huh.
Who arrive about halfway through uh-huh. the wedding. And all the servers had to be women.
So tell me, how did you staff this?
I'm trying to remember. We probably flew about 30 chefs over there to prep and to serve out the meal. But we got a lot of assistance from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, who we partnered with. Mm-hmm. They were wonderful. We were able to prep in their kitchens. They procured the ingredients for us, mm-hmm. whatever we didn't fly over from here. And
what kind of menu? Was it a Middle Eastern menu, or did they want to?
They told us that they wanted, I believe it was 7 or 8 courses, and that they liked a lot of butter and a lot of cream. So I thought of my FCI background. and that they wanted full-size portions for each course, not tasting portions. So This is for women.
In hot weather.
One of the courses we served out of an ostrich shell. We did a soup out of an ostrich shell where we had a faux pearl on top. And
wow, how big is it? An ostrich shell is huge, isn't
it? It's huge. Well, you know, the top was like a cloche,
okay, essentially. But, so you served it as a tureen? Or did
each person got their own ostrich shell?
Wow! And 1,200 ostrich. Where did you get the 1,200 ostrich eggs?
You'll laugh. Ostrich.com, which is now out of business. We probably put them out of business because they ran out of shells.
Did you? And so you purveyed them in the States?
Yes, we did. We had them cut in a certain way. And our biggest fear, you know, you had to keep each top and bottom together, because no two shells are alike.
Oh my gosh.
We were very nervous about the serve out of that course.
Tell me something. Did they request this ostrich dish or something with ostrich? Are ostriches native to Qatar?
No, they just wanted something with visual impact.
Did you come up with that in your mind? Had you ever done it before?
No.
Oh, this is the advertising background. My gosh. My daughter's wedding, we're definitely doing this. Oh, my God. So what did you do with the egg? How big was the yolk? How much did it weigh, the yolk?
That we get the eggs hollowed out already.
Oh, you do? Oh, okay. So who makes that omelet?
or souffle?
Oh, that's fascinating. So, what did you put in the... I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with this. What did you put in the ostrich shell?
We did, this was a couple years back, as a truffled cauliflower soup.
Oh, how delicious. My gosh, you really couldn't serve that night after night in a restaurant, could you? Those ostrich shells would take so much room.
Yeah, and cost so much money.
So, Nan, tell me what else was fascinating about cooking in Qatar.
Well... it's just a totally different culture. When we went out there for the tasting, they wanted us to prepare the tasting in a kitchen that the sanitary standards were not...
up to a HACCP level. Okay.
Yes.
Wouldn't get an A from Mayor Bloomberg's health inspectors.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. So we ended up doing it out of the Sheikha's pantry, which wasn't really properly equipped, but we made do. And that's what catering's all about. You find solutions. Mm-hmm. You're always running into problems, but it's not a problem because you find a solution.
Any interesting products that you could work with out there?
Well, When we were awarded the event, I sent a team back to investigate, you know, what equipment was available. And they said, well, there's a camel cooker. You put a whole camel in it.
Do you skin it? A whole camel cooker.
A whole camel.
My gosh. They ended up getting this sounds like a spare no expense wedding.
It was spare. Well, you know, it always starts out that way. And then, you know, they... But one of my biggest fears was we shipped the ice cream from the United States, pre-scooped.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, when you're doing something for royalty, the airline that's owned by the Royals, I believe it is. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, they had an in with the airline.
Yes.
So, you know, we figured it was going to be a fairly safe thing. But the ice cream got held up a day in customs.
Did it melt?
My pastry chef, who is such a genius, had it so well packed with dry ice. He was a nervous wreck, too. But it was perfect when it arrived.
Oh.
So
So tell me, are there special airlines that or do you just use Royal Emirates and put it in cargo?
We used Qatar Air and put it in cargo, and they were wonderful. It was a great airline.
Oh, really? So it just goes on a normal flight.
Normal flight.
And do you have special pack, like you did the dry ice? But did you have to learn about?
We did. We had to have. We had to work with a freight forwarder who, you know, worked with all the regulatory issues and the.
You as chef really had to. This takes you way out of the restaurant realm when you have to.
We had a wonderful project manager who did all the research, so I could focus more on the food.
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break here. Okay. When we come back, we're going to explore some other avenues with you.
Okie doke.
This is Chris Howell from Kane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Kane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit kane5.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And today, I'm talking to a French Culinary Institute grad, Jenny Glasgow, who is the executive chef of Olivia Chang Catering and Events. And we've just heard about an amazing wedding in Qatar for 1,200 women. Okay, let's get back to the States here. The transportation to me is a huge thing. To make something delicious is hard. We all know going into a restaurant and expecting someone who has a full-blown kitchen and a full staff, we expect greatness. Well, when you have that special day of your life where you're going to want the meal of your life, but it's going to happen to be someplace that doesn't have a kitchen, what are the challenges there for what's the inside challenge for the catering chef?
Well, the inside challenge is each time we develop a new dish or hors d'oeuvre or whatever, is not only to train the staff to make it consistently and train the staff on site to pick it up consistently, but as you were alluding to, transportation. What's the best point of finish that we should take it to in the kitchen? What should be done a la minute, and how should it be packed? Because, you know, you have sometimes waiters unloading trucks. They may not be as gentle with the food as you would like them to be. I mean, they try. You really have to safeguard against every possible thing that could go wrong. And there's been a great learning curve over the years. The more years we do this, the better we get at it.
Give me an example of a disaster and how you put it right.
Okay. We did a dinner years ago in upstate New York. It was a dinner for 300, as I said, not in the city. It was at an art museum. We had a dessert that needed to stay on the refrigerated truck until service. Because there was no room for refrigeration on site. Mm-hmm. So during the dinner serve out, our SANIT captain comes up to me looking white. He said, "We have a problem." I said, "What?" He said, "The desserts fell over in the truck."
Well, what was the dessert?
It was something in a chocolate cup. I think it was some sort of a mousse in a chocolate cup. And then we were going to garnish it a la minute. Fortunately, it did not literally fall over into the truck. There was no sanitary issue. The issue was that, quite a few of them, the majority of them, were smashed. It being an art museum, everyone put their heads together, and somebody had the wonderful idea of trying to salvage the ones that were intact as much as possible. The ones that were not intact, going crazy with all the garnishes on the plate and making that the Jackson Pollock plate.
And it worked.
It worked.
Because it was still delicious, right?
It was. My heart was in my throat the entire evening.
Oh,
but it worked, and we did the event for them the following year. So
okay. So for all those aspiring cooks out there that want to be a caterer, what does it take to be a catering chef? What do you look for when you're hiring somebody in your kitchen?
Energy. Discipline, good palate. It's, you know, catering prep is very different than restaurant prep because, A, you are taking things to a different degree of finish than you are if you're doing stuff a la minute in a restaurant. So you need more cooking skills, I think.
Really? Explain
that. Because you're searing things off in advance, which you wouldn't necessarily do in a restaurant.
So you have to know where to stop.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got better technical skills.
And you've got to think through till the end. I'm not saying better, but different. I'm talking about a prep cook in a restaurant versus a prep cook in, obviously restaurant cooks need great skills, and I tell all young people that want to come straight into catering that they should go work in a restaurant for a couple of years because you get skills that you can't get anywhere else.
Like what?
Precision of plating, like thinking on your feet when you're picking up six different dishes in your station, like a respect for food.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing volume, and not as is proven by our dinner for two, not everything that we do is volume. You sometimes have to approach prep in a slightly different way. But what I'm looking for in people, aside from energy and, what I started to say is you need a certain internal discipline too, because sometimes you get stuck doing something boring if you're doing volume production. So you've got to play little games with yourself because you know the next day you're going to be doing something challenging and fun. Mm-hmm. No 2 days are ever alike in catering, which is to me, the most exciting part about it. And the most exciting part also is that you learn every day. So people that think that they know everything don't have a place.
In catering. Well, in your kitchen.
In my kitchen, whether it's a catering kitchen or a restaurant kitchen.
Because
I sure don't know everything after all these years. And the day that I do, I'm just going to, you know,
How have your menus changed over the 11 years? Are you affected by trends? Or have you evolved? Tell me about your style.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely affected by trends. It used to be that in catering, if you started doing something that was a trend in a restaurant 2 years ago, you were still avant-garde in catering because catering was always a couple years behind. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that it's gotten much more competitive and there's a lot of great caterers out there. And you do want to be on top of the trends while still being true to yourself.
So what's the trend now?
Well, it's funny because last week in the Times, there was that big article on granola. Yep. Well, we're already doing a savory granola as a garnish for a dish. I mean, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. But, the other thing is, as a caterer, it's a lot more client-driven than a restaurant. You kind of, to an extent, have to be all things to all people. So we've got clients that are really into farm-to-table. We have clients that are very into molecular gastronomy. We have clients that are purely visually driven. And you kind of, your heart may be in one of those areas and not the others, but you have to be all things to all people. And to me, that's a challenge that makes my job interesting.
Mm. Do you have a favorite type of client to work with? Do you like weddings? Do you like events, you know?
Well, weddings are nice, but I tend to love... we've done some spectacular events with some of our fashion clients that are just, you know, produced by these great production
companies.
Can you
describe one?
Well, we did a an event for Gucci a few years back during Fashion Week at the United Nations, where Madonna, it was a fundraising thing for Malawi, for her Malawi charity, mm-hmm. and there were great performances. And
how do you compete with, how does the food compete with Madonna?
Well, that one, actually, they wanted very simple food, great ingredients, minimally mm-hmm. messed with. Mm-hmm. Very, it was almost rustic, the food.
So how much is plating part of the catering, you know? How's the look? Because I would imagine at these fashion things, a lot of people don't eat. They look.
They eat with their eyes. You know, it's some events they actually do eat with their mouths too, and that's that's really gratifying. But visual and wow factor, and you know, I confess to always looking for the next gimmick because people want that. Mm-hmm.
Is it 50? I mean, when people come to you, do they say that the look has to be fantastic and it has to taste incredible, all of the above?
Yeah. I mean, they're expecting a restaurant quality meal. And, you know, by restaurant, I mean a good restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the challenge is being able to serve anywhere from, you know, 100 to 500 to 900 people at the same time.
So does the menu option go down the more volume people that you have to serve?
Yes. And also, you know, budget has also got to be an issue. If the budget is large enough to adequately staff an event, that helps.
So those huge events, are they mainly corporate events?
Mainly. I mean, weddings tend to be more around the 100 to 400 mark or 300. Mm-hmm. Some of the big corporate events have really been... when I say corporate, the core of our clientele is high-end fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's great to do something with partners who have taste. Such style
yes, and taste. Taste. So in all of these events, do you have one favorite that you just think was expressed you, your food, your style?
Probably an event that we did for Hermes several years back downtown at the Cunard Building, where we partnered with an amazing, amazing PR firm that did this beautiful, beautiful production of the event. And there was like an enchanted forest with pastries hanging from the trees and a cheese station that was like a real artisanal cheese shop. And in fact, we even had fromagers there explaining the cheese. And a beautiful raw bar. And, you know, a lot of the food was fairly classic, but it was just great ingredients, like the best of the best. Mm-hmm. The setting was breathtaking. Mm. You walked in and there was the sound of the horse's hooves clopping. It was really beautiful, beautiful event. But we've done many like that. That's just the first that came to mind.
It sounds like you have a real fun life.
It is fun. It's a lot of fun. It's hard work, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for coming by today. This has been quite an education for me. You know, we learn something every day, and boy, did I learn a lot from this. So, Jenny, good luck to you. And the next time you have one of those big events, can guys sneak in?
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Okay.
This is Chef's Story. I just want to shout out to Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee. Thanks for producing, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.